we've done is in the past, and we'd like to have you do the same if you would please, is just give us an overall view of what's going on in Casper and Natrona County from your perspective as a DA there and what you think's happening. And we've talked a lot about caseloads, drug enforcement, various things, whatever you want to talk about, to give us an up-to-date from your perspective. And then we may ask questions about that. Then once we get that completed, we'll get into your budget, and we'd like to go through it page by page. So welcome. Identify yourself, please, for the record, and the floor is yours.
Is that on now? Okay, there. Thank you, Chairman Bebout, Chairman Harsh, and members of the committee. My name is Mike Blonigan. I'm the district attorney in Casper. I've been the district attorney for about 10 years now, and I've been prosecutor for about 30 years now, which seems like a long time. But, Frank, as we go through Casper, one thing you might note is we actually have traffic. We actually have growth. We seem to be doing very well as far as growth in our area. The one interesting thing about that is compared to the last cycle we had is that we're not seeing quite the increase in crime that we saw the last cycle. Now, we've had some increases in our felony numbers, but not above historical averages. We've been low for the last several years, so the fact they're moving up is, while expected, it's not what we did expect. What we find that many of our people in the energy industry, frankly, now are a little older. Don't go out and Yahoo it up quite as much as maybe they did 20, 30 years ago. In fact, it seems to be a lot of the same folks that were working at it 20, 30 years ago, and they're just a little bit older now, and they seem a little more likely to stay at home. We continue to see drugs as a large part of our caseload, about one-third of our felonies. Methamphetamine has not at where it was, say, 7, 8 years ago when it was epidemic, but it remains a serious problem. Prescription drugs are a growing problem, as I think you all know, and we're seeing more and more of that. Those particular instances, most of our instances, we're seeing we have a situation where we do have repeat offenders and quite a few of them, but we do seem to be making some progress in that area. Our recidivism rates are slightly lower. As far as violent crime remains fairly steady in Casper. We had not had any homicides for a couple of years. We average about 3 a year historically, going back more than 50 years. If we don't have 3 1 year, we have, you know, 4 the next. But over time, it tends to balance out. And that has remained relatively steady. One area we continue to struggle with is impaired driving. Our numbers remain high. They are down significantly this year, but that's only because the last 2 years they've been up so far. They had to imagine them continuing to go up in that regard would be unreasonable. They are starting to drop. I would like to say this is just enforcement, but we're seeing an average blood alcohol content twice the legal limit. That tells me that we're not taking, you know, close cases. Those are cases that are pretty well established by physical evidence as serious impairment. They continue to draw quite a bit on our budgetary resources. The Hickler homicides we have tend to take a lot of expert testimony and things like that, so we see that drawing on our budgetary needs. As far as the other things in Casper, we really are in a period of relative calm, although we're quite busy presently. We're guilty of bad timing, if nothing else. We do have 3 first-degree murder trials all the same week in 3 different towns this February, so that's a bit of a challenge to my office. Unfortunately or fortunately, we recently lost Brian Christensen from our office, who was a tremendous asset in our juvenile programs and our community programming. He has become a circuit judge in Casper, so he will be moving over to the circuit court, and we'll be looking on to do that. We do see some pressure on staffing, from salaries, things like that. When things are good, we find that people can make a pretty good living in private practice and things like that. We're starting to see more of that than we did before, perhaps some risk of staff moving on and we having turnover, which is something I really haven't had much of in the last 10 years. So that is something, again, I know the the committee and the legislature are considering some small raises, some cost of living raises, things like that. I think those things help tremendously. Even though they might not always be the most amount of money, they do recognize the employees' value and benefit, and they do help us retain things. As far as the office itself, you'll see from the budget, we cut one permanent position in the last round of cuts. We are maintaining that cut. Our staffing is presently adequate, but that is about where I would leave it. For instance, we cut that one staff person, and it wasn't a big problem until we had another staff person gone on FMLA. And we found that that was enough to cause some real problems. So our staffing seems to be at relatively minimum levels. Caseloads are manageable but busy. We continue to maintain some rather separate functions in the office between juveniles and misdemeanors and felonies. We found that works best. The simple truth is if you have six judges, you have six judges who think you should
be. Let me interrupt you, Michael. We were trying to figure out FMLA. I think I know, but tell us, please.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman. The Family Medical Leave Act.
Yeah.
So that person had a sick child and had to be gone for some substantial period of time. And so the staffing's adequate when everybody's there, but if you have a situation like that happen, things get a little more difficult to handle. So there are no requests for current positions, but that may become an issue in the future. We continue to maintain two grant positions, both through the federal monies, which we have maintained for some substantial period of time now. I think we all agree we don't know quite what's ever going to come out of Washington in the next few years. So that, again, is an area that bears watching as it has in the past. I'd stand then for any questions by any members of the committee.
I'm getting ready to finish chewing. Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Vlonigan, I know that your office has also been handling some, like I know there was a big murder case down here that you were handling. Is that paid for out of the Laramie County DA's budget, or, I mean, how does that work budgetary-wise when you go to other parts of the state to help on cases?
Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stepson, those expenses are paid by the county that requests your assistance. In fact, that's what I was doing down here today was that case is 2.5 years old, and hopefully we're going to finally get it resolved, I hope. But the county pays for that. Now, I would say that I don't bill all those. I have a state vehicle, for instance, and it seems rather silly for me to bill another state agency to pay for the state vehicle for me to do state business. So, but otherwise, hotels, experts, any of the witnesses, travel costs are covered by the agency requesting assistance.
Mr. Chairman, is there any extra charge to cover your time or part of your salaries, or is that just on your nickel?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, no, there's no coverage for salaries that would be paid. And, of course, we would continue to be paid by the state of Wyoming, whether that's Laramie County or whether that's Natrona County. So.
Okay. Further questions? Senator Perkins, and I think Senator Perkins and Representative Nicholas have these. You present them into the legislature. Okay. Senator Perkins.
Thanks. Mike, on the, is it looking at that, what's a junker, first of all, what's a junker case?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, that's basically parlance for a minor case that would normally not have an independent file open. It simply doesn't sustain enough action to cause the whole file opening process, such as a traffic ticket, things like that. Then what occurs is occasionally we have problems with those. People don't pay fines or they have a failure to pay a warrant. And so a miscellaneous file is created for those minor matters and sometimes referred to as a junker file.
Okay.
Can you follow up?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just interested in a couple of categories, if you think we're having increase, decrease, or holding steady on certain types of crimes, and one of them would be domestic violence. First would be first category.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, we find domestic violence continues to occupy particularly a lot of our misdemeanor docket. If you look at all those misdemeanor cases listed, I would estimate that 20 to 25% of those are domestic violence cases or domestic violence-related cases, such as violation of protection orders, interference with 911 calls, things like that. It, again, is an area which has remained relatively steady throughout my time there. It goes up a little year each year. It goes down a little each year, but it remains in a relatively narrow range of change.
Mr. Chairman, and the next one would be DUIs.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, as I indicated earlier on the DUIs, we are down somewhat this year, but I don't take a lot of comfort for that because we've been up so sharply the last three or four. We have had some significant drops. There's some things, though, that I'm not seeing that I would expect if we were this was due to enforcement and to other things. One is the average blood alcohol is not dropping. If this was just tighter enforcement, I would expect lower BAs, people maybe not detected before that were being pulled in. That's not occurring. Secondly, is our number of repeat DUI offenders is increasing. You know, you talk about fourth time DUI and you think that wouldn't be a lot of folks, yet it continues to go up each year. Each year we seem to have a few more people, and I think as I break it down, this year, we had 31 felony DUIs filed. That's fourth time or greater. The first year we did this, we had six or seven. So we see a persistent level of repeat offenders. And those, frankly, are the ones that concern me the most. Sometimes folks make mistakes, and they can work through that, and, you know, that's fine. But when you have these repeat offenders, and I can't ignore the fact we also have more vehicular homicides than we were having a few years ago, and I got to think the two are related. So,
okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, if I can continue the
next
one would be interested in if you're seeing any uptick or if you with it'd be on abuse of child abuse.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, no, I'm not seeing that. Again, is something it remains steady to even down a little bit. We seem to be doing better in that area. And we certainly are getting far fewer felony child abuses than we used to get. And at the same time, our abuse neglect referrals seem to be doing a little better. We're handling a few more of those out of the juvenile court system rather than in the juvenile court system. And that seems to be trending slightly downward.
Okay. And then the last one, I mean, you'd seen that. We talked to Scott a little bit earlier about this, but up in the Star Tribune was talking about the concern was on rapes and how many rapes go unprosecuted. So I've read the paper, but I'd be interested in your point of view.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, is we got to remember that that's going to be a function of two things. Basically, whether those incidents are reported, I think there's a high level of incidents that go unreported. Secondly is whether they are sufficient evidence to proceed with prosecution. That is a very difficult thing. We remain pretty entrenched in our society in a rather negative view of sexual assault victims. They often occur in situations where the person will be subject to, you know, some pretty searching cross-examination about what they did and didn't do in drinking and things like this. I don't find, though, that that's much changed than it was 30 years ago. We have tried some very... Now, on the other hand, if we expand that, I'd say that's about adult sexual assaults. On the other hand, we have increased prosecution, it seems, in the child sexual assault area. And one of the reasons for some of the assets that have been brought to bear on that, specialized training for police officers, using things like our child advocacy project, which has increased the value and investigation. And also, I think recognizing among police officers and other in law enforcement that the type of sentences these cases are presently drawn will mean that they are heavily litigated. I mean, we used to fight to get folks to the penitentiary. Now they're handing out 20 years without blinking an eye. So that has increased, I think, some of the efforts in that area. In fact, we do see an increased prosecution of child sexual assaults.
Okay. Anything else?
No, thank you.
Yeah, well, I have one question, and we talked to Scott earlier this morning. Senator Perkins mentioned that, and one of the questions was in terms of the domestic violence, what percent are either drug or alcohol related? And he essentially said it was 100%. Would you have a similar reaction to that same question relative to Natrona County?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I would say that a very, very high percentage of all of our crime is substance abuse related. I know Ernie Johnson's group did some numbers and had it in the 80s, and my response was, well, that seems low. we are more struck by the fact that there's not drugs and alcohol involved, in fact, than there is. That's an unusual event. And so much of our crime has a deep root one way or the other. Maybe it's just coincidental, not a root, but it's in drug and alcohol abuse. It's a key driver.
Okay. Any other questions, committee? Okay, if you would please go through your budget.
Yes, the budget, let me say, for this year is relatively straightforward and simple. It's actually a lower base budget than we submitted the last biennium. We did have one personnel position cut. We are maintaining that cut. On page 3 of the document, you will find a general series-by-series breakdown of the various expenditures that are involved in this coming proposal. This, of course, does not include the grant positions, which are 100% funded by federal grant monies. In this particular instance, of course, we continue to be largely driven by our 100 series expenditures. You'll note we only have about $270,000 that isn't personnel related in one way or another. We are, of course, this is one of the difficulties with cutting an agency like this. It is, I did the percentages once upon a time, but it's somewhere around 93% or something like that, personnel related matter. The job description of is set forth. That's fairly consistent. It does include in the last few years a few new duties that the legislature has assigned to us, such as the single points of entry. But we were doing a similar sort of program before you ever required that. So that didn't result in that big of a change for us. We continue to run our community programs. That includes a special juvenile probation program, a juvenile diversion program, and adult drug court in efforts to see if we can't divert some people out of those standard systems and deal with them in a manner that is more rehabilitative rather than punitive. We have not had so far cut any of those programs, and we do think they are one of the reasons we have maintained relatively steady caseload growth, even though our population is growing, is because of those programs.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Perkins.
Thank you. Just if you know, Mike, we've got the adult drug court, and you've got the juvenile or the teen drug court. Do you have any idea what how successful those are? I mean, if we look at reoffenses within a year or two or three, if you have any of those, do you have any idea what the success rates or failure rates are on those?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, I don't have those particular numbers with me. We have found, though, I recall them being quite positive, particularly if you go to a 3-year mark. We don't think much of a year or two. 3 years out or more is preferable. We do seem to have some good results from that, but I don't have the specific numbers with me today.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Stubson?
In a different vein, you had mentioned you have your grant-funded positions, and I just wanted, I know in your narrative you talk about there's a, mess up the HIDTA, grant-funded attorney, a grant-funded victim witness coordinator. Are those the only grant-funded positions you have?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stubson, that is correct. And we have maintained those as single grant sources and avoided mixing funding for those because mixing funding, quite frankly, is something of a nightmare. The HIDA position has been present since 1999, and the victim witness one, I think, might be 1 year younger than that. So we have maintained those over a long period of time and continue to attempt to do so. as I said, we simply don't know what might come up down the road here. HIDTA tends to be a very popular program with bipartisan support on the Hill. Violence against women is equally, usually pretty well supported on the Hill. So we're somewhat hopeful, at least for the next 2 years, those are in pretty good shape.
Okay, continue. Yeah. Oh, Senator Meyer?
Just a question on HIDTA. I guess they're U.S. attorneys, essentially, but do they work under your direction, or do they work under the direction of the U.S. attorney, or how's that work?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, those individuals work under both of our supervision. Being divided this way, if you are involved in a federal prosecution of a case, direction is made by U.S. Attorney Mr. Cross. If it's a state case, then I am directing their work. The attempt is to try to approach these investigations on an organizational basis, rather than simply saying, oh, you take these two and you take these four, and you know, we'd see better results when we attack the organization as a whole. That so far has been fairly successful. So it depends. If you are doing a federal prosecution, you'll be under federal supervision. If you're doing a state prosecution, you'll be under state supervision.
Go ahead.
On your task force officers, is that primary? Does your office get involved with task force officers, or is that primarily with local law enforcement?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, our task force, our drug task force, Central Wyoming Drug Enforcement Task Force, is where most of our cases come from. We do also street-level cases where officers find drugs, things like that. Most of our investigative work, such as controlled deliveries, major conspiracy investigations, are done by the task force.
Follow-up, Mr. Chairman. There is some discussion that that overtime is almost essential when you go to your task force officers because criminals don't commit crimes from 8 to 5. So I guess from our funding perspective, the AG's office has asked for more task force officers, but they haven't said anything about overtime. And I'm just wondering if the money would be better well spent with more task force officers or some flexibility in overtime, and what your perspective would be on that.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, I think both are essential, but one thing I'd say about HIDTA and our DCI task force participate in HIDTA, and I happen to be on the HIDTA board of directors, so I have some knowledge of this. We pay a lot of the overtime costs, so I think there might be the thought might be, well, as far as the overtime end of things, maybe we get some help from HIDTA. From the personnel point of view, we have to get that through the state, so I think that's why the extra officers might be asked for rather than the overtime in this particular instance.
Senator Perkins?
Thank you. Just a couple of follow-ups on that. So with respect to your task force officers, how valuable do you think that maintaining that task force, the task force and the in its current configuration is, and if so that's the first question is, how valuable do you think that is to your office and accomplishing the mission of your office for the 7th Judicial District?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, I think it's very important. I've been through several reincarnations of this task force concept over the years, and this is by far the most efficient one I've seen so far. There's a couple of things that happen here. One, the task force draws not only from DCI but from local law enforcement agencies. One thing I find that very valuable for is communication between those law enforcement agencies and joint efforts between them. You know, if you have a Casper police officer on there, he's going to go back to the Casper police officers on the street and bring that knowledge into the organization. Mm-hmm. So as long as information sharing, I think, has gotten much better. Secondly, there's almost two classes you can get, and obviously we're talking drug cases here. The task force efforts are almost all drug cases. Is that there is a different sort of law enforcement that's happening at that task force end that's happening on the street end. On the street end, I'm going to worry about what I run into on a day-to-day basis. Maybe I have a local department doing small-time deliveries and things like that. Without the task force, you don't get the in-depth investigation you need for these organizations and really go after the guys that you need to go after doing the serious, serious stuff, you know, moving pounds of methamphetamine and things like that. I think the task force has done a much better job of working complex cases and detailed cases than any other configuration I'd seen previously. So when you have that come to your office, you just have a lot better case to deal with. Secondly, or thirdly, they're professional. They're specifically trained in the nuances of these investigations. So they're not going to make the mistakes that untrained people might make. They're not going to do stupid things trying to buy drugs and things like that that call into question the fairness of the proceeding and things like that. So I think all those things together bring us a better case than we'd have if we did not have those task forces.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
And then the other one, I've got to ask this question because this is going to come up. So doing the math, I went through your staff and added up the one, and I've come up with 22, and then the total authorized employees are 19 on the budget, and I just need you to help me understand the difference.
Okay. Well,
so if we've got 19 authorized and you've got 22 listed, you've got the 9 attorneys, the 3 victim witness coordinators, the 1 office manager, the 7 legal assistants, and the 2 youth diversion officers.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, we do not pay the diversion officers at all. Those expenses are totally borne by one from the Natrona County Sheriff's Office and one from the Casper Police Department.
Okay.
So those two positions aren't listed, are not compensated through the office at all.
Okay, and then, Mr. Chairman, so that gets us down to just the difference between 20 and 19, then. We just have one.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, I'm wondering if somewhere along the line here we didn't forget in that narrative to change the person we dropped last year.
No, okay.
I don't have an extra person sitting around.
That's a good reason. That's a lot better than some other ones we could think of.
It could be that that's the math, but it's the table itself is the correct. And perhaps that was an editing error on my part.
Okay.
But that is correct. That was that receptionist / legal assistant position that we eliminated to meet the budget cut request last year.
Probably down to 6 then. Mr. Chairman, yes. Probably down to 6 instead of 7.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and talking about budget cuts last year, you did, in fact, reduce office personnel. Your reduction was $170,000. More or less, and the governor's recommend was 93,
mm-hmm.
and you maintain that reduction is what you've said.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, we maintain that reduction.
Yeah. Okay.
Moving on to the exceptions request, they're relatively few. There are 4, only one of any real consequences. The first one is computer hardware. We were running our computers a lot longer than most agencies. And
how long is a lot longer?
Mr. Chairman, I average 6 years. ETS came in and almost just fainted. They said, you can't be doing that. They're looking more at a 2-year replacement.
I would hope they would not come to my office because they would faint. My personal office. Go ahead.
And so we did replace out of this biennium's budget the attorney's computers. Next step is to replace the support staff computers. They have reviewed that. They have approved it. And that is the amount of $12,345 you see in priority number 1 on the exceptions request. And, again, I would expect that to change going forward. They have indicated to me they would like to maintain a fairly steady replacement cycle, and so I would expect these requests to become more frequent.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Blanigan, it appears to me that you didn't, that if you, just because ETS says that you can replace them doesn't mean you need to. So the question is, were your computers working okay until you replaced them?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, we were having increasing compatibility problems. The software was too old to interface with other agencies and things like that. So we were certainly moving that way. In fact, even now we're waiting for further upgrades in these computers because we're having to run out-of-date software until we can have some changes in justware and things like that. So, yeah, we were hitting that point. I mean, we probably would have been here anyway. I don't want to imply that it's only because ETS came here that's the reason this request is made. It was coming down the pike anyway.
And then one more question, Mr. Chairman. With regards to your Westlaw, do you have Westlaw for every lawyer on staff?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, we do.
And I don't see any a request for an increase for your budget for Westlaw. Is there a need for it, or do you know?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, so far we've been able to maintain fairly close to what we've been doing the last several years. So we certainly are using it, but we don't need an increase presently.
Okay. Continue.
There are a couple of other minor exception requests, Mr. Chairman, just briefly, and that is in-state travel and out-of-state travel. I know from looking at this, these look like very small amounts to you, but again, we are, you know, supposed to submit our expenses to the body. This represents a 10% increase in in-state travel. This is real simple. It's just the increasing cost of gas and things like that. That we have people, for instance, I had people that I brought with me today, but that we were down here talking to people from the crime lab about upcoming homicide case. I have to go to Loveland after I'm finished here and talk to them. It's not that there's more travel. It's simply that the cost of that travel, and particularly fuel, if I reimburse somebody to come to Cheyenne and back, it's about $200. I mean, because of what we're paying on mileage. So that's a small – that's the source of that. I do know that it has been noted that this was an area that the overall administration has cut, but it does reflect those increased costs. And the same with the out-of-state travel. We have a relatively small out-of-state travel budget compared to, say, Laramie County. But this is simply, again, it's not that travel would increase. It's that the cost, if you bought airline tickets lately, if you bought hotel rooms lately, there's just an increase in cost, and that is also recovered there. The final small matter is they raised our bar dues. We have to have a law license to practice law. And for the 10 attorneys that I have in the office, that's a total of $500. Again, it probably could be gained from another source, but it was an additional expense that we documented for this presentation. And those that is the total of the exceptions requests found in the proposed budget.
All righty. Questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Hassan.
I was going to ask this earlier, and I was thinking of it after your counterpart had left, but and if you covered this, my apologies, but what denotes what sort of cases go to a district attorney instead of a county prosecuting attorney? I mean, you know, we talked a little bit about, you know, I mentioned earlier in with your counterpart, Mr. Homar, that, you know, I talked a little bit about my frustration with public intoxication as opposed to DUIs when people make that decision. He says, well, goes to municipal court, and that's usually not something you guys deal with too much. But then I was just thinking, what denotes how a case gets shuffled?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hastert, a lot of this is determined by the existence, for instance, on your public intoxication issue, of city ordinances. The only place you can get in trouble for being drunk under state law is on the highway. There's an intoxicated person on the highway. But, for instance, just a person walking down the sidewalk here, state law doesn't cover that. That has to go to city ordinance. So the first thing is it covered by a city ordinance or is it covered by state law? Secondly, city ordinance has adopted in some respects, particularly in traffic matters, the Uniform Traffic Code. However, a large number of municipalities do not prosecute DUIs. Now, ours does, and I know Cheyenne's does. But in any small locations, they do not prosecute DUIs. Those all go through the county prosecutor's office or the district attorney's office. So what it is really a combination of authority under which ordinances, which laws apply, and the second is often policy matters. For instance, we recently shifted a bunch of our DUIs back to the city because they're running an alcohol court to specifically deal with these people. So there'd be policy consideration, and then quite often it's a question of whether you have a state law or whether it's governed by local ordinance.
Mike, and I think you talked about it in your opening comments, but how long have you been the district attorney? Just give me a historical perspective. It's been 10 years now?
Yes, Chairman Harshman, it's I did 2 years in the criminal division down here, starting in 1983. Then from 1985 to the end of 2003, I was an assistant district attorney, and I've been district attorney since December 2003.
So it has been 10 years.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Just kind of, you know, I think, and we're just, I don't know what, whether there'll be a question in this editorial, but we've done a lot of action on DUIs in the legislature in the last 10 years, 12 years. And just kind of looking, you know, how is that? Have you seen that corresponding kind of trend, or what's the trend like in the last 10 years in your court, DUIs? And like I say, some of them are prosecuted in the city. Maybe you don't.
Yes, Chairman Harshman.
You talked initially about these four-peat felony guys.
Right, and Chairman Harshman, I think that's the real difference, is there's actually some different tools to handle different offenders now. You know, if you have a tool to handle a fifth-time guy versus a first-time guy, you're better off. Secondly, I think our treatment programs are better, not only in the community, but in the penitentiary as well. There's some very good treatment programs being run in the Department of Corrections. And sometimes when a guy hits bottom, you know, nobody says it has to be incarceration instead of treatment. It can be incarceration and treatment.
Yeah.
The most disturbing thing I find is the relatively high BAC we continue to run on the average. We're running in Wyoming between a 157 and a 162, depending which county you pick. So we're not talking close calls here. This is twice the legal limit. As far as prosecution goes, I think most of the tools have been provided. We do find an increase in the number of tests with the search warrant authority the legislature passed, and it is, you know, the nice thing about tests is a nice objective piece of evidence. It's not, you know, somebody's impressions. It's
right.
Something. And so we've found the prosecution. I think right now the missing link more than anything needs to continue to be public education. And you do see some progress. I think young people today are much better giving up the keys than perhaps when they were my age, more designated drivers, things like that. So the one disappointment I have had is the ignition interlock devices. They simply don't seem to be having the impact I'd like, probably because that they're administrative and they're not tied closely to the criminal justice process. If we saw a requirement in your criminal case, you give proof, you know, you had that thing, you had it installed, you used it, perhaps it, you know, you think you're making progress, then somebody says they had their 8-year-old kid blow in the ignition interlock so they could drive home from the bar. Leaving, of course, unanswered the question is why is your 8-year-old kid with you at the bar, you know? But you know, so
well,
we do have some.
Can blow into the air ignition. Yeah.
Or friends that go and help their people by blowing. Well, why didn't you give the ride home rather than blowing in his interlock for him? So we've not quite captured the noncompliance rate with interlock is quite high. I thought Wyoming's was outrageous till I heard other states and found out. Well, we're doing bad, but we're not doing as bad as some. So
what do you think about? You know, some of the things, some folks think maybe we've gone too far, too fast, particularly folks who have CDLs. I mean, and if you get caught on a Friday in your personal vehicle and how that can affect really mm-hmm. your opportunity to work and pay taxes and take care of your family for the rest of your life. I mean, where are we at? What's your thoughts on something?
Well, Mr. Chairman, first note on the CDLs.
And I'm not talking about the guy driving his big rig right. And getting caught. They throw the book at those guys.
But the CDL stuff comes to us almost completely from D.C. It is almost all federally driven. What you guys pass, what you guys do, really aren't the drivers here. It's CDL. And I'm sure Mr. Lofton has been in front of you before saying, you know, if you don't do this with CDLs, we're going to lose federal highway funding. So that's really driven by there. You know, if they're in their big rig, I really don't have much sympathy for them.
No, none of us do.
But the other hand, should there be there's maybe some room there, but I don't think this body can create it. I think if there's going to be special circumstances and things, something has to change with the CDL and what's coming down through Federal Department of Transportation. You know, that's really not
that's what we
keep
kind of hearing. We're going to have them later, and we're going to try to really figure out where actually it is all – where the mesh actually hits it, and I don't know that we know it.
You know, and Representative Harshman, Mr. Chairman, I really believe that, too, is that, again, if we could get a meaningful ignition interlock device that would go in that, you know, my biggest concern is that big rig's not going down the road with an impaired driver. I mean, I think that's
our
concern.
No doubt.
But, you know, are there other things that can be done? Unfortunately, I think it's one of those things where, you know, Washington sits back and says, this is the way it is, and you guys want that federal highway money, you darn well better do what we say. So it might be one of those problems we can't fix from here.
Sure. Okay, thank you.
Senator Perkins.
And just following up on that, one of the other things that I keep hearing, you know, anecdotal evidence about is on non-alcohol DUIs, and the one that there ends up being a fairly substantial number of those, but two is that the difficulty that there is in prosecuting those. And I'm just wondering from your experience if you see anything or anything that alarms you there with respect to non-alcohol DUIs.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, this is an increasing area. And if you want to take a look, you can go down in Colorado where I think their marijuana-related DUIs doubled or tripled since medical marijuana came along. You know, if somebody says, well, it's legal now. I say, well, it's legal to have a quart of whiskey. It doesn't mean I can drink a quart of whiskey and go driving down the highway. These are a real problem, and they're a real problem in a couple of areas. One is identifying them, and our officers are getting better at that. We're training them on that. The second thing is, what do you do? We all know what drunk looks like. What does high look like? Well, it's almost all cognitive stuff. It's not stumbling down the stairs, things like this. There are a couple of things some states have done. One is a threshold level in nanograms in blood, not urine, because in blood it's on the brain. In urine you have different issues, particularly with marijuana.
Nanogram?
Nanograms, yes.
What's a nanogram?
I forget which thousandths of a gram it is, but it's fairly common in toxicology. And a 5-nanogram threshold is pretty well accepted. You know, we could look at going to thresholds on that. But this is an increasing problem. Now, generally we get both. And so what will happen is the guy's a 1.8, but he's got something else on board. Well, I got a 1.8. We'll just go deal with that. The tougher ones is where it's simply medications. And sometimes it's medications that have been prescribed to people, but they have no business driving. So this is a growing problem. We have had vehicular homicides from dust off, you know, people huffing dust off and blacking out and going into the other lane of travel. So literally anything that will intoxicate you, somebody will find a way to use it, and they seem to feel compelled to use it in an automobile. I don't know why, but, you know, why you can't leave the can of dust off till you get home at least, I don't know, but they're driving down the highway, and they're out like a light. They're in an oncoming lane of traffic or rolling off the side of the road. So this is an area that continues to grow, is non-alcohol DUIs.
Go ahead.
So, I mean, I can get, if you can go out and you set a level for nanograms, would apply to medications or various controlled substances, would that show up in a dust off, which isn't that just like compressed carbon dioxide, or
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, we have actually been able to capture. There's a fluorocarbon in the propellant, and that's what they're gonna. If we're lucky, that's if you get a sample, if it's taken by somebody who knows what they're doing, if they get it immediately refrigerated. Oftentimes, you will not get a positive. They're very hard to get a positive on. So you have these problems with prosecuting these. If you have independent evidence of what they were ingesting, that's can be taken care of. When you don't have that independent evidence and what your results might mean is a much more difficult proposition. You know, is it found in blood? Is it found in urine? What's the level? Who tells me whether that level is impairing or not? You know, sometimes it's apparent. You see the video and the guy can't hardly stand up when he gets out of the car, just like a DUI might be apparent. But those are some of the problems that come up is what are those standards and how do I prove them?
Senator Dockstader, and then we'll get John.
Mr. Chairman, we ventured off the budget, but I want to hear this before we leave. It comes back to you're talking about we're still picking them up four times or greater on DUIs. You say that the legislature's done their part. 6 years ago, we had, you know, some significant legislation come through, got a lot of press, but here we are, we're back with four times, and your feeling is it comes back to education. Well, who does that fall on? Does that fall under one program or a group, or who takes care of that education?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dockstetter, I think there's a lot of requirements for that, but some of those is what you're seeing through the Governor's Council on Impaired Driving and other public institutions, getting public awareness out there. You know, it has come to the schools. It's got to start being accepted in society. You know, we train our children. I mean, how are we training them? You know, do we train them that we have eight drinks and drive with them in the back seat or not? So, you know, to specifically say you have one person or one obligation, I do think some of the things we've seen, like the advertising campaigns, like the designated driver campaigns, you know, Tipsy Taxi is another thing that's worked out in my community where, you know, we get people sober rides home, things like that. So there has to be awareness. The problem we have with awareness is it seems to go up when we have some terrible thing happen. You know, we get five kids killed in a crash and everybody's all ready to do something, and then 6 months later, you know, we're back to the... So I think you're in the slow process of changing behavior, and it's going to take a long time. It's not just going to be something we accomplish in 2 or 3 years.
Okay, Senator Hastert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for the record, Nano is a billion.
Billion.
But off the DUIs there for a minute, Terry, just back on domestic violence, we heard it earlier, some of the numbers for domestic violence cases in Laramie County from the 2012. And it seemed like there was considerably more domestic violence cases here. And there was speculation that, from Laramie County to Natrona County, and that some of it had to do with law enforcement awareness and education and in the different areas. And I just wondered if, how that is and who trains them and is if maybe law enforcement in one area is not getting the same type of training for the awareness of it. And then I'll have a follow-up, Mr. Chairman. You had mentioned that there was quite a few misdemeanors. I wanted to just ask the felonies on domestic violence, and then if domestic violence tends to be a lot higher number of cases that actually go to court, where you'd have, where you actually have court time, than other types of crimes.
Yes, sir. Mr. Chairman, Senator Hastert, first, I think one note of caution on the numbers is it's not so much a question of the training of the police officers. I think they're pretty similar. But it might not be reporting as domestic violence. It's getting reported as an assault or assault and battery, and it's not being tagged as a domestic violence, and I think I've seen some of those reporting issues. So, again, and the other way might be a report. When they file the report, are they filing one incident, top count, in other words, the most serious offense, or are they firing each one individually as an individual case? So I don't know that there's a lot of difference between what's happening in Casper and Cheyenne on these things. I think it's largely a statistical-driven thing. As far as I can tell. As far as felonies, yes, we continue to have a significant number of felonies. We had, I think, 560 felonies last year. Probably 100 of those or so were domestic violence. That's either multiple offender, it's aggravated assault, it's homicide, it's strangulation cases. They do tend to cause substantial court time because they're more likely to be contested. The reason they're more likely to be contested is because of the pressures and various things going on with the victims. We tape record phone calls from the jail now, almost everywhere. And it's amazing, these tape recorded conversations you hear where the guy with the no contact provision is calling up saying, well, this is what you're going to say, and you're going to go in and tell my lawyer this is what's going on. Now, we go back and we find that stuff, and it's great evidence, but you can imagine there's all the internal pressures on these victims we all know about. Then you add the external pressures. So a lot of these guys, they're talking to their cellmates and everybody else, going to say, you know, you just wait a while. She'll back off. She'll recant. And that doesn't necessarily mean we won't prosecute it, but it makes prosecuting a lot tougher. So what that translates to is more court time because you're contesting more issues. You're unlikely to resolve it in an easy manner. You're going to litigate those things. So it does cause more court time. But the amount of pressure some of these people are put through, you know, and it'll say right in the beginning of the phone call, this is tape recorded. We listen to everything. And you still have these conversations. Well, it was your fault. You provoked me. You know, you shouldn't have talked to me that way. You know, if you would have just listened to me, this wouldn't have happened. And, you know, so there's a lot of, we do spend a lot of court time because, quite frankly, these guys think they can get away with it. So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, I would say of those 560 felonies we had last year, roughly 100. That's not a specific number, but it's around that. It continues. It's our most common violent offense, felony offense, is probably against a spouse or against a live-in partner.
Okay. Representative Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to go back to the 5-nanogram issue, which I have done a lot of research on recently. And the fact is that in that was a number that was just pulled out of the air in Washington State. There really is no scientific basis for that. And the medical cannabis users, such as epileptic children or people who are treating themselves for nausea and pain, will have massively higher levels nanogram-wise in their systems and not be at all impaired. In fact, not even have any psychoactive effects going on at all because of the varieties that they are using. So I think that's one of the problems in dealing with this whole issue, is the fact that there is no way, except perhaps being able to pass a field test. And I guess that's my question to you. My understanding is that law enforcement has tools available to them that they can ask drivers to go through certain things to indicate whether they've got good balance, good vision, or if they are driving impaired. So if somebody is driving erratically and they are stopped and they fail those field tests, whatever they are, is that enough for you to prosecute them and be able to take care of that? Because I'm as concerned as anybody else. I don't want impaired drivers on the road. But on the same token, I also think that, you know, just a simple numerical blood level of 5 nanograms, which apparently from the research that I've done is not necessarily indicating any kind of impairment. I'd hate to see those people unnecessarily, unfairly prosecuted.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallace, I think the characterization as the 5 nanograms pulled out of the air really isn't accurate. Colorado did a lot of research on this because for years they couldn't come up with a number like an 08 on our DUI because they didn't have enough cases. Well, when Colorado passed legal medical marijuana and it continues today, they got so many cases, they actually launched a study of this. And, you know, 5 nanograms, it doesn't matter whether, you know, if you're an 08 alcohol, you're an 08. It's a toxicological fact. I can be an experienced drinker, an inexperienced drinker. I'm impaired. And it's the same is true of other drugs as well. But what officers can do, and you train them in, is called a drug recognition expert. And these are officers who received specific training in controlled substances as opposed to alcohol and what to look for and things like that. So you can do this. Yes, you can prosecute them. Is it harder? Yes, it's harder. It's always easier to deal with a known toxicological fact than interpreting field maneuvers. And part of this, as I said, is the cognitive thing. What does high look like? Well, a lot of times it's you know, understanding speech, putting together. It's not stumble down the road, things like this. So is it possible? Yes. Is it harder? Yes. That's why some states, and the Washington experience was kind of a trade-off. It was an interesting kind of, it was more of a political thing. Is that they said, well, we'll do this, but we'll throw in this. And that's kind of how they actually ended up with it on the books. But it is always harder to try a DUI, and I don't care if it's alcohol or drugs or a combination, without a test than it is with a test. I mean, that's, you can do it. There are things you can do, and there's things the officers can do. but they do have to be trained in them to recognize, you know, this is not alcohol, it's something different.
Right, Sue?
In Colorado, where I interviewed some patients recently, and they told me that their blood levels, nanograms, was consistently 4 to 5 times higher than that. But I was sitting there visiting with them, just like I'm visiting with you. They were obviously not impaired in any way at that time. And they are on a protocol where it keeps the levels fairly at the same constant level in their systems in order to treat their conditions. So has Colorado actually prosecuted people under this 5-nanogram system? And have they dealt with those issues?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Wallace, first, they haven't passed it in Colorado as a per se standard, but they've done the research down there is what I'm saying. They certainly do prosecute for drug impairment in the state of Colorado. And although on certain drugs and even with alcohol, we might see individuals who don't appear impaired as we sit and talk to them, that does not mean they're processing things the way you need to drive. You know, regardless of whether you support this idea or not, marijuana in particular has one of the same attributes as alcohol. In fact, some people say it's worse than that, is ability to divide my attention when I'm doing multiple things. I can concentrate on that one thing, great, but now I got this car coming over here, the things we need to do to drive. So I think that there are some significant impairments there, and I really think it's a separate issue, you know. Whether we drive, and for instance, in Wyoming now, if I'm taking painkillers as my doctor prescribes, you know, and I'm taking them just like I'm supposed to, if it's too much for me to safely drive, I still can't drive. And it'd be the same thing with medical marijuana. I could legally consume it, but if I can't safely drive, I can't safely drive. So I think they're really two separate issues.
Okay, Representative Escobel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mike, what are you seeing in your trends with the meth labs up in your neck of the woods?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Escobel, as it's been for some time, I haven't seen a lab in 3 years, 4 years maybe. Wyoming never really got most of its meth from labs. It got it from down south. It was coming out of Southern California, Arizona, and Mexico. The labs are dangerous, and when you get them, you sure want to get rid of them, but we haven't had a lab, actually, gosh, in a long, long time.
Well, just to follow up, we had an incident just recently, and how would you differentiate between someone that's actually doing it as a criminal act and between some young kids maybe getting together and getting on the Internet and trying to do something stupid and they get caught? And would you, prosecute them the same way?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Escobel, no, they're different people. You know, I have somebody that delivers a quarter ounce of marijuana. I don't treat them like somebody selling pounds of methamphetamine. They're completely different people. Some of the things you'd look for is what are they in the end producing, because I suspect if they're the kids, like you say, they're not producing much that's very good. Secondly, can you confirm those things? Can you, you know, do a computer search warrant and find out, yeah, these are kids looking at it? The size of the operation, how much is it capable of producing? You know, kids who are just messing around don't have some capacity to produce several ounces at once. You know, they got these little, you know, is the equipment sophisticated? Is it not sophisticated? All those kind of things, you know, because you want to differentiate between those people. You know, between stupid kids you can do something with and, you know, somebody that says, well, this is business, you know, I'm Breaking Bad, you know, and I'm going to make this my business. Those are completely different offenders.
And then, Mr. Chairman, back on the DUI issue, has technology advanced enough now to where bars can have those portable breathalyzers in there where you would just take the straw out and blow, you know, put 50 cents into the machine and blow into it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Escobel, you'd probably get something that would give you a presence of alcohol, but actually this machinery takes some degree of sophistication and maintenance if it's going to remain calibrated. and work accurately. If I was a bar, I wouldn't have one in there for anything. I just see somebody, you know, sue me saying your machine said I was an 05 and I was a 2.0. Maybe that's just thinking like a lawyer, but I just think that's a bad idea. So, yeah, but one thing the liquor dealers and the bars have been very good on, not just here but in Laramie and other places, is this idea of a safe ride. We're not going to argue with you, fight with you over whether you had too much or not. What we want to do is get you a safe ride home. And we've seen over in Laramie, this is great, and Casper's working great. I think Cheyenne has something going now. This idea that we have an alternative to driving our vehicles, I think, might be something the community can really get behind. And I know our liquor
dealers. Yeah, they always do. Okay. Anything else, committee? Anything else? I think that we will probably not need a call back. I appreciate you being here and your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you,
Keep
Mr.
up
Chairman.
The good work. If we need you, we know where to find you.
Yes, sir.
Okay, we're going to take a, while you're coming up, we'll take a two-minute stretch. Public defender. Are we live? Welcome. It's good to have you here, and I really appreciate you being flexible. And we've had a couple things come up as a committee and different things scheduling-wise, so thanks for being flexible. And what we'd like to have you do is give us a general update as to what's going on in your world, what you're seeing. And, we realize there's one capital case out there, and it's a big part of your budget, and you spent a lot of money already, and there's more to be spent, and you've got some requests in there, and maybe you want to touch on that a little bit. Anything else you see out there that you want to talk about, and we'll hear from that, and we'll have some discussion with the committee. And we'll interrupt as we see, just when those are on our minds. And then once we get through that, we'd like to have you go through your budget, pretty much page by page, front to back. And, you know, maybe we'll work. I'd like to work through the lunch hour to get it done. We'll just see how it goes.
Okay.
So welcome. Please, for the record, identify yourself, and the floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairman Bebout and Chairman Harshman and representatives and senators. My name is Diane Lozano, and my official title is State Public Defender. What that really means is I'm the director of the Public Defender's Office, and we have two divisions, the Public Defender Division and the Guardian Ad Litem Division. With me today I have Becky Meza, our new fiscal officer, fairly new. She's been with us for about a year. The deputy for the Guardian Ad Litem program, Dan Wild, is also here, and he may need to help me with some Guardian Ad Litem questions if you have those. And then the deputy state public defender, Ryan Roden, is also here. And, again, as a public defender, I'm used to being flexible. It's probably no different than being in court, which I miss doing. So as far as the schedule changes, we have no problem with that. You know, somebody asked me yesterday, one of my friends, they wanted to know how big the state public defender office was as an agency relative to other budgets. And, you know, I said, you know, I'm not so sure that I have an answer for you or that it matters. But that I can tell you and what I'd like to share with this committee is certainly our task is large. On the public defender side, as you know, we have a constitutionally mandated obligation to provide effective assistance to counsel to our clients. One of the handouts that we provided last Friday to you is a breakdown of our five-year caseload trends. As you can see, in the last 5 years, our caseloads overall for the state have increased by 5%. When I say caseloads, what that means is newly assigned cases to our program. If somebody gets charged with a state crime, misdemeanor, or felony, they appear in court for the first time, and as we all know, they're advised if they can't afford to hire their own attorney, that the state would provide one for them. As it turns out, the public defender's office represents about 88% of those people in the state of Wyoming every year. Over the last 5 years, I would say maybe it averages at 85%. And maybe more importantly, the second graph on that sheet shows how many new cases each attorney or each FTE gets in our office each year. And that has increased to over 10% in the last 5 years. So our caseloads are going up. We reached, we went over 14,000 cases a year for the first time ever. That's probably twice the amount when I started in 1994. But our attorneys, we've cut back on some attorneys. We've had some turnover, but certainly our attorneys are getting busier and busier every year.
While you're on that particular subject, you know, the cases, the numbers are significant, but also the types of cases. Could you speak to that? Are they more complicated, simpler, taking more time?
I will, Mr. Chairman. We do have a what we call a case-weighted database, and so we try to take into account what our types of cases are. Certainly a capital case, we don't even rank that because that is so complicated and that is such a different type of case that takes a lot more resources and a lot more time. But certainly a violent felony is going to take a lot more time and require more of each attorney to handle those cases than misdemeanors. As far as just numbers go, about 70% of our caseload are misdemeanors, so not generally complicated cases. But over the last 2 years, our case-weighted average has increased also by about 150 points. So it does seem that I don't know what the overall statistics are on violent crimes, but I can tell you, for instance, in Fremont County, each one of my attorneys is working a homicide of some kind. Those, as you know, are difficult cases. So I think the complexity of our cases has gone up as well as the numbers. So in order to be effective, our attorneys have to have what we call manageable caseloads. Manageable for a public defender is probably a lot different than what would be manageable for a private criminal defense attorney. There are no national standards, but in 1973, the Department of Justice had a commission look at standard caseloads, And the ABA and most offices look to those still to this day to determine what maximum caseloads are. And what that is a breakdown proportionally between felonies, misdemeanors, and juvenile delinquencies. And, for instance, one attorney should never handle more than 150 felonies a year, 400 misdemeanors a year, or 200 juvenile delinquencies. Our attorneys handle a mix of those, so we try to figure out what that means. Overall, our agency is at 83% of maximum caseload, but I have a couple of field offices, namely Laramie County, who is over the 100% of maximum caseloads, which generally means to me that they have so much going on that I question whether or not they can provide effective assistance to counsel. So certainly caseloads drives a lot of what our budget requests are and a lot of what our needs are. But also to be effective, I have to have an attorney who knows what they're doing. They have to be competent. So that means I have to make sure that they get adequate training, that they're up on the nanogram issues for non-alcohol DUI, that they understand DNA. A lot of our cases now have DNA and that high-tech things that we don't learn in law school. So our attorneys have to be trained to understand those. The other big part of what it takes to be effective is what kind of resources do our attorneys have. They have to have adequate resources to consult with experts in those types of nanogram cases, as I said, or capital cases. As you can see from our budget request and as we go through our exceptions, I think a lot of what our budget exception request is driven by those types of things, that we need experts in our cases, that we need expensive experts in some of our more expensive cases. As Chairman Bebout mentioned, we do have one active capital case in Laramie County. We have provided a handout on what we've spent on capital cases in this biennium, and it wasn't, unfortunately, just that one case. Fortunately, this is the only case that's going to trial. And when a capital case goes to trial, the expenses, go through the roof, so to speak. But during this biennium, we paid on three capital cases in Park County, two in Fremont County, one in Platte County, and then the one here in Laramie County. In the biennium prior to that, we paid on, I believe, only one, and the biennium before that, none. So capital cases, for whatever reasons, whether it's just that these horrible crimes occurred in our state, unfortunately, in the last biennium, or whether there were some charging decisions that we have no control of.
Is that the $665,000 from July 1 of 12 to October 31st of 13?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman.
And all of these are they all they've had the trial and the decision's been made as to the you know what they're going to be, how they're going to be treated, and then through your intervening and doing what you do and what. Okay, who decides? I mean, once if there's been a capital crime committed, a jury trial, and the judge has rendered his opinion and the jury's decided and the sentence has been given, who decides? I mean, obviously, whoever receives that sentence is not going to like it. So is it an automatic thing? They say, I don't like it. I want to have counsel. Is that pretty much how that works?
Well,
or do you weigh the case? I don't know how you weigh them when it's a constitutional right.
Right.
How does that work?
Well, certainly the prosecuting attorneys make the decision initially whether or not they're going to seek the death penalty.
Right.
And sometimes that's a formal decision, and sometimes it's just that they've told the court we're thinking about it, or they told counsel that they're thinking about it. Once that happens, that defendant is entitled to counsel. They're likely entitled to counsel just merely because it's a homicide case and they're looking at life or life without parole in prison. Once they've gone, through the processes, fortunately for us, all of those cases except the one that that is going on in Laramie County, they entered into a plea agreement and the death penalty was removed from the equation. So they all got life without parole sentences, essentially, in those cases. Once the jury makes the decision and it's a jury verdict in these cases, and then the judge hands down the official sentence, an appeal is automatic, so we then also have to represent them on appeal in a capital case, which might cause some problems and cost us more money down the road, which is a reflection in our exceptions request number two. Right now, a capital case in Laramie County, his lead attorney is my lead appellate counsel, so it's likely that we're going to have to find somebody from the outside to handle that appeal. So, again, that's another chunk of money that we need to worry about.
What happens on the reservation when the FBI is usually involved, and And then there's those cases out there, if it's within the reservation and it's in federal court, I would guess, are we as a state required in those cases? Who provides their counsel for those situations?
Mr. Chairman, that would be the Federal Public Defender's Office.
They do that.
We do that. We would not have to worry about those cases.
That's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Diane, I think, too, thanks for being so flexible. Appreciate that. Was it 14,000 criminal cases in your narrative this past year?
Right,
Mr.
Chairman.
I read that. Yeah, 14,000 plus.
215, right.
And you might have said this. I just wanted to, the percentage of those that are pleas then?
Mr. Chairman, that's a great question. I couldn't give you an exact number. We could start tracking that information. We don't. I would say anecdotally it's 95% or greater.
Really? And how does that compare then to a private defense attorney? I mean, I don't know, maybe. I mean, sometimes I hear from constituents that say, hey, I just get offered these plea deals. I'm supposed to plea or it's going to get real bad with the public defender. And I don't know, if you had big money and you hired some big name and this and that, would it be a plea deal? I don't know. This isn't my realm of my life, but so I'm throwing that out to you.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. And I, my guess is that the more complex the case, it doesn't matter whether you have a public defender or a private attorney, you're likely to litigate a lot of things and likely to go to trial, homicide cases. My guess is that we handle most of those complex cases. In my experience, when I go to court in Laramie County and I see private attorneys in court, they're generally entering into those same plea agreements that we are. I think that the criminal justice system is just as busy as it is, and it could not function if every case went to trial.
Sure. Okay, thank you.
You know, along that same vein, too, and I think it was the state of New York, and I remember an article, and you've probably seen it. It's been several years ago where the plea bargaining thing got so bad that it just created a lot of abuse. And, we're not even close to being there, but I'm sure you see that when you talk to your fellow uh-huh. public defenders around the country, how this negotiating takes level, takes on a certain new life of its own.
It does, Chairman Bebout. But again, I think that goes back to caseloads. And no matter what your caseloads are, we're probably going to enter into plea agreements for our clients. Most of our clients say that they did it and they just want the consequences mitigated a little bit, or maybe we think the prosecutor charged the wrong charge or what have you. The problem I think that the country is seeing right now in Washington, Michigan, Missouri, all these states that have lawsuits pending, is that the attorneys are too busy to even meet with their clients. It's called meet and greet. You meet at the microphone and you tell them this is the plea agreement and you have to take it. Certainly we're not anywhere near that in the state of Wyoming.
The attorney-client privilege, and of course we have several attorneys here that know a lot more about it than I do. When you have that relationship as a public defender with your client, and you have that, and that's in place, mm-hmm. and then you plea bargain and it's over, then is that obligation continues to stay with you, correct?
It does, Mr. Chairman, it does. Technically until the defendant passes away is the standard.
We don't want the word to get out that the clients don't want to have their relationship be terminated because of the – yeah, okay. I got you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nicholas.
I probably should know this, but what's the current capital case that's here in Laramie County? And where is it at in the litigation process?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas, Nathaniel Castellanos is our client, and the trial starts February 18th. So we are there. And it should be a 5 to 6 week long trial, depending on how that goes. And so one further thing that I would add about the state of life at the public defender's office on the public defender side of things is that we did, for this last fiscal year, as you know, reduce our budget. Most of that came from the 900 series, and the 900 series is where we pay for our overflow conflict counsels, our experts, and technically on our capital side. And I would be honest with this committee to tell you that we're struggling to maintain that budget reduction. I think mostly it's because of the increase in caseloads. For example, one of the reductions that we made that we thought we could live with was we reduced the number of contract attorneys in Laramie County by two, and the two of them together carried one caseload. They were part-time contractors, and we had to add one back in because the caseloads were getting such in Laramie County that we could no longer, our attorneys were not being able to take time off were feeling as if they were meeting their clients at the courthouse for the first time. We may have to add another contract back to Laramie County. The Laramie County office alone had 2,300 new cases last year, which is about 800 more than the next busiest office in the state.
Mr. Chairman, in your report you indicate that some district court judges are requiring reimbursement when the defendant runs out of private funds, and then district courts are doing that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas, I think it's a smattering of them. I think we've seen the most of them from Laramie County. And what that is the Public Defender Act, which was created in 1978 and hasn't changed much since then. It allows for defendants who first hired private counsel, so they first had money, and then for one reason or another became indigent and they need an expert on a case, the attorney can apply to the court for the public defender to reimburse them for those experts. The way I read the statute, the courts don't have a lot of discretion. I'll tell you that in my mind, a couple of the cases we've paid on, I believe the private attorney probably got enough money and should have been able to handle that case, but that's not what the court ruled. The court ordered us to pay it. We had to pay it.
And Mr. Chairman, is there a mechanism where you communicate with the court and say, look, if that's going to happen, then we want to take over the full prosecution or defense of the case. Otherwise, they're going to run up a bill that they know that it's going to get paid.
Right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, yes, we do have communication. The statute actually requires that the state public defender be served and heard by the court. We normally at least have the court ordered them to go through our fiscal processes. They have to submit a request for the services. They have to abide by our rules. If we have to write a contract, then they have to honor those rules. Most courts are good at capping the amount, so that helps, no more than $10,000, and then the attorneys know that. We had one case, though, that was on appeal out of Fremont County that, a loan cost about $60,000. Because that statute also allows the court to order us to pay the attorney for his fees.
Mr. Chairman, does the court then address they pay comparable charges per hour under your rules and regs or however that works?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas, the Wyoming Rules of Criminal Procedure do say that an attorney can get paid up to $100 an hour. We've only had that happen one time, and I believe the attorney was, I believe that was the hourly rate, was $100 an hour.
Okay. Senator Perkins.
Thank you. I've got a series of questions I'd like to ask, if I could, Mr. Chairman. First one would just be, with respect, I think you were here for Mike Bonigan. I asked him, there's four areas, DUIs, child abuse, domestic violence, and then a sexual assault. I'm just wondering, with respect to those, are you seeing any trends that are alarming you, either with respect to the frequency or anything as far as the commission of the crime, and also any trends that concern you with the way that those cases are being prosecuted from your perspective?
Okay, Mr. Chairman and Senator Perkins. I would say not really trends that are alarming. We don't track how many DUIs we handle or child abuse or sexual assault. We could do that, and if this committee wanted us to do that, we could gather that information. I am seeing more felony DUIs, and probably that's because within the last 10 years people are piling those up. I would guess that we don't have a lot of child abuse cases. I don't know why that is. Sexual assault cases, I would agree with District Attorney Blonigan that we're seeing more child sexual assault cases. And, nothing alarming about about how those are being prosecuted, but those are the types of cases that require us to get experts sometimes. A lot of times those cases don't have separate physical evidence. It's just a child has made a statement, and we need to look at that statement. We need to have an expert look at those kinds of things. And I would say that the only thing that, and I don't know, alarming is probably too strong of a word, but domestic violence cases can be problematic for us. I would agree that what District Attorney, it sounds like District Attorney Homar told you that they have a lot of them here, and I think how those cases are handled and how they're charged and if they're charged and pursued is a matter of policy, so each county is a lot different. For instance, if we have a district attorney who has a no-drop policy, That can mean that despite what the victim says, despite what the evidence shows, that they're going to take that to trial no matter what. And our Laramie County office tries domestic violence cases probably once a month. On a Thursday afternoon, if you wanted to go over to the district court here, you could watch a domestic violence trial.
Mr. Chairman, so from terms of, like, constitutional notions of fair play and things like that, is there anything that you think that you're seeing that you think is unfairly tilts the balance of the scales of justice in favor of prosecution versus defense that you're seeing in the state?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Perkins, that's a difficult question to answer. I suppose it depends on types of cases. I certainly believe that prosecutors, for the most part, have access to greater resources than we do, but at the same time, other than what we have in our budget request, I don't believe that we're an underfunded agency, so to speak. Good county attorney, good district attorney's office should have their evidence investigated and ready to go by the time it gets to them, and we're always kind of playing behind the ball. I would point out that the Wyoming Supreme Court has come back lately with some prosecutorial misconduct findings in a greater degree than they have recently, so how that plays out, we'll see.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, you touched on this, but I just want to ask it directly. When you compare, I'm assuming that you or some of your deputies have the opportunity to actually view occasionally the work or the work that you're, and the advocacy of the public defenders that you have working for you. And how do you think they compare favorably or unfavorably or equally with the private criminal bar?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, I believe I have the best attorneys in the state. But there are some caveats to that. The busier an attorney is, I believe the less effective they are. In Laramie County, and that's the county I know the most, so I keep going back there, but it is our busiest office. You know, we have attorneys carrying over 200 cases, and they don't have a lot of time to probably litigate issues that they should in those cases and advocate. Whereas a private attorney in criminal defense, and I don't know, they may have two or three criminal cases going at once. So as far as courtroom skills, I think we have the best. But because we're busier, maybe we're not as good as some criminal defense attorneys in the private bar are.
Mr. Chairman, just a quick editorial comment. I think backs that up. I've had a private conversation with a judge just about this mm-hmm. issue, and he actually tells and what the judge told me was that he thought that they compared very favorably. In fact, mm-hmm. he was concerned about the quality of advocacy in the private bar more so than with the public defender's office.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perkins, that's good to hear. And I would add, I guess, too, that I know we have some judges who would prefer to appoint the public defender's office in a county in a close case where maybe the person owns their home. And to most of us, that seems like they should maybe be able to hire their attorney. We've had judges in counties tell us that they would rather have a public defender handle the case because they feel that it would be handled more effectively and efficiently than that. And certainly the more complicated the cases are, the closer you get to a capital case, and those capital cases, I don't believe that there are private attorneys who could do the job that the public defender attorneys do.
You know, one of the obvious questions, I should know the answer to this, do you do eligibility tests on people that request you to defend them to an extent? How do you do that?
Mr. Chairman, the court actually makes that determination. By statute, they have to fill out what's called an affidavit of indigency, where they weigh how many assets they have, what their debts is, what their income is, and those types of things. But the law is that if there's any question, you should appoint the public defender's office. We've had lots of judges who want us to come up with some.
Most of the people that you defend don't have a CPA preparing their audited financial statements.
That is true, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of latitude there. Okay, any other questions? Representative Stubson.
Mr. Chairman, in just glancing through your budget, I didn't see anything, but I wanted to make clear, you don't get any types of federal grant funds or anything like that, do you?
We don't, Mr. Chairman and Representative Stubson. In fact, the Public Defender Act says that our budget is funded 85% by the general fund, 15% by the counties. And if we were to go get federal funding, our general fund budget would have to be reduced by that amount. We administer a grant, but it's not part of our budget.
Okay, are we ready to do the budget?
Mr. Chairman, one more question.
Oh, Representative Nicholas.
I just found this in my notes, Diane. I've had several attorneys question me here in town regarding the bond conditions that are imposed like on a first DUI out of county court and whether or not they're constitutional or not, and whether or not they go through the proper proceedings of, and if you go in and ask for a bond hearing to reduce it, to remove an Alka-Seltzer or whatever those obligations are, but they don't have the funds to go out and do a challenge to the Supreme Court on those issues. I mean, have you been presented with those issues? Is that something that, to me, it's something that the public defender ought to do, just as a public service, if the courts are not following the bond laws the way they should be. But could you just opine on that a little bit?
I can, Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas. Yes, that issue has come up quite a bit, actually, and the ABA just did a study on bond conditions and whether or not they're too onerous and whether or not we're violating constitutional rights. Again, whether or not each attorney feels like it's appropriate to do it in that case, I don't necessarily get involved in that individual case scenario. In order to challenge what a circuit court judge does at that level, you have to do a habeas action, so that's pretty time-consuming. So, again, how much time do our attorneys have? But I will tell you that we've got some brilliant appellate attorneys, one in particular who we've decided to task him with looking into that so that we can help our attorneys out on the ground at the trial level. So we are looking at it, and I agree that there may be some problems.
Okay. Are you attorneys through talking about all these different issues? No? No? You remember in the legislature we're paid by the hour. No, we're not. We're outcomes-based. Okay. Okay, what we like to do, we're going to work through your budget, and, we're going to take whatever it takes, and so that's what we're going to do. So please, let's get in your budget page by page. Tell us where you are and where you want to start. Let's go.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I think it probably makes sense then just to jump to page 12, which is our first exceptions request.
To have you start before then.
Okay.
Let's look at start on page 8.
Page what, excuse me?
8.
8. Oh, okay, yeah. This is just the breakdown, Mr. Chairman, of what our budget looks like if you break it down. Again, to tag on to what District Attorney Blonigan said, a large percentage of our budget is in the 100 series. Those are our attorneys and our legal assistants and our investigators. We have 5 investigators. To the extent that other than what we've made in our exceptions request, other than, I guess, one sort of government recommendation that I'd like to discuss with you, that budget seems pretty like something that we feel that we can live with along with our exceptions request. So I don't know specifically if there were questions about.
Anybody have any questions on the standard budget? The only thing that I would ask you is when we did our budget cuts during the last session, you ended up, I think, having a reduction of $200,000, $170,000 general fund, and then $75,000 came from the capital cases. And then $30,000 was other funds. Total that you had was $901,000. That's the number you had in terms of reductions?
I believe so.
Okay, and then you did not biennialize those reductions, correct? You only did them for the 1 year in this next budget session. And now you've come back for more funding. Is that correct?
Right. That's okay. Correct.
Okay. Please continue.
I mean, I guess that on page 8, too, I guess I would like to add that given what our capital case funding is and how much we think that this case is going to cost us without getting any more capital cases, that, we're running in this budget year, we've asked for one B-11. We may have to ask for another B-11, and we've also have an effective immediate request in capital cases. So I kind of wanted to put that out there for everyone before we start looking in more detail. On page 9 and 10, we've outlined again in our narrative what it is that we do, what our caseloads are, how many employees we have. We haven't cut back on the number of employees again, but we've cut back on the number of contract attorneys. We cut 2 in Laramie County, added 1 back. We cut a contract attorney in Rock Springs in Sweetwater County. That one's getting a little bit tight, and we cut one in Torrington and one in Campbell County. So that's where we are as far as personnel and the attorneys who are available to do our cases.
And one of the things that you and I think Co-Chairman Harshman mentioned, 14,000 cases that mm-hmm. you have, and that's in your narrative. And, you know, to me, as an engineer, you look at the cases and the number of attorneys divide, you get so many per person. You said some of them may have 200. How does this compare to other states? Every state has this obligation. They all have public defender's offices.
Right.
Have you done any analysis? You know, it's hard. You can't compare it to New York. I'm sure that right. in New York, it's probably 1,000 cases per attorney. But what about in our region? Are there any comps?
There is, Chairman Bebout. There aren't that many actual state public defender offices. Most states run on a county basis or
county. They still have the data.
Right, but the rural counties or the rural states do what we do, and we're comparable. We're not as busy as the public defender's offices in Colorado. They shift their attorneys around from town to town. You know, population-wise, I think we compare well with caseload-wise with Montana and South Dakota. So, you know, we're good. The bigger the jurisdictions, it's not. We hired an attorney from Kansas City who came in and who was handling 400 or 500 cases at a time, and now she's down below 200, so she feels better about it. So I think we're doing okay that way.
How much of your caseload is driven by the legislature and their mandatory minimum sentences that we pass these laws, and what percent of your cases are in that category?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that drives the caseload necessarily. Mm-hmm. Those people would get lawyers anyway, but because of the mandatory minimums, those are cases we're more likely to try and litigate issues. So they're going to take more time for us.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Continue.
Mr. Chairman, just quickly.
Senator Doc Satter.
Could we get those numbers again? You gave us maximum caseload for a public defender. Could I get those again?
Right. Annually, an attorney is not supposed to have more than 150 felonies a year, 400 misdemeanors, or 200 juveniles, and that's if you just did 150, or you just did felonies. So we try to prorate that. The numbers, the percentage of those should not be greater than 100%.
Thank you.
Okay.
On personal services on page 9, I would point out that we have 24 legal assistants in our 14 field offices, so our budget request doesn't reflect this, but we certainly don't have the number of legal assistants that prosecuting attorneys have. So, again, maybe that's a little bit of an imbalance in that regard. We have asked for a legal assistant as an exceptions request on the guardian ad litem budget, which starts later on in the budget book. As far as support services, data services, we do what ETS tells us to do. We meet with them. They tell us what we need, and then our budget requests are based upon those, and we do have an exceptions request based on that. We went in space rentals in the 500 series. We finally have moved the Laramie County Trial Division into the courthouse, so we no longer are paying rent in Laramie County. The administrative office, all of the people you see here are in a state building, so we've reduced costs in that regard. But we still are paying some lease in Lander, Rock Springs, and Cody. But the counties also have to supplement that, so we are getting help from the counties by statute to pay for those rentals. The contractual services, as I said, they are namely or mostly we have attorneys who have a contract with us for the biennium, and they handle a caseload for us in any given field office where they're located. So that's a big chunk of our 900 contractual services, but the other chunk is expert services, which would include bringing somebody in a vehicular homicide case to help us decide who was driving or what the cause of the accident was, mm-hmm. all the way to having interpreters for our non-English-speaking clients. That series also covers trainings. One of the things that we didn't think we could sustain in the budget cut, and we'll talk about that when we get to
When you do your contractual services and entering these contracts with the attorneys that work with you, is it just, you know, is it the amount of money you pay per hour based on the type of case or the complexity of it or the experience of the person, or it's just here it is and it's pretty much standard?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, pretty much standard. We pay anywhere from a mere $45 an hour to $50 an hour, but it's based on however many hours or the type of the percentage of caseload, I should say, that they do. So a half-time contract is $3,900 a month, and that's what they get every month, and it goes up to maybe $5,850
a month.
You
know, it's sort of interesting that we spend $40 to $50 an hour to get good counsel to represent the people in need, and yet under the Equal Access to Justice Act at the federal level, they pay certain environmental lawyers $700 or $650 an hour that we pay for.
That's true.
You have to wonder where the balance is. Go ahead. That was an editorial comment, Committee.
That's fine. Thank you.
There is a question in there. I just can't remember what it is. Go ahead.
And then on page 11, if anybody had any questions about our special revenue or the public defender fees by statute, courts have to order public defender clients to reimburse the state for the cost of their public defenders. Again, that's based on ability to pay constitutionally, if they don't have the money to pay it back. We are working on a standard fee schedule that will help the courts know more what to order in each case. It's sort of all over the place. Some attorneys track it by hours, some track it by case, but those show the last 5 years what we've collected from our clients. And that money goes right back to the general fund. It doesn't go into the public defender checking account, so to speak. So that goes immediately back to the general fund. Okay, then on to page 12, which has our first exceptions request.
Mr. Chairman, with regards to page 12, could you give us a more particular breakdown of the $370,000 that you've spent regarding the mitigation costs for the capital cases, I believe that must be?
I can, Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas. Because it's a capital case, we have to follow what the United States Supreme Court and the Constitution requires us to do, and that requires us to investigate our client's whole life history, and that's what we call mitigation for the most part. And mitigation really is anything about the defendant, his life, his background, we're supposed to go back three generations when we investigate these cases. That requires us to hire an investigator who's specialized to do that, and those really are the big costs in capital cases. And the main reason that is because it's very time-consuming. But we can't necessarily put a number on what that costs for each case. If we have a capital defendant who was born and raised in Wyoming and everything we need to know about him and all the records are located in Casper, then that's not going to cost us as much money. We're not traveling all over the country, all over the world, interviewing people. Unfortunately, we've had cases where we've had clients born in another country. Whose family is scattered throughout the United States, some of whom speak English, some who do not. So we have to have maybe a mitigation specialist who speaks Spanish doing some things. We have to have somebody maybe go out of country who's familiar with Guatemala, for instance, to do those things. Probably the most expensive mitigation specialist cases, though, are ones where we have severe mental illness. Those require a special – most of those mitigation specialists are actually attorneys.
And what is this particular $370,000 for? I mean, what case and what mitigation work was done?
That's in the effective immediate. Is that correct, Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas? That's what we feel we need to get us through the capital case trial that we have right now. So we've already spent money, we've encumbered money, and bringing all the experts and the witnesses and everybody here to Cheyenne, Wyoming, is going to cost us approximately that much money. That if we don't have it in March, we may have to release money for our contract attorneys for the last 3 months of the biennium to pay.
And looking at page 12, you've already spent $370,000, and you want another $250,000.
Okay, I got those confused.
So the $370,000, that's primarily for your mitigation expert,
right.
And that was on the one capital case you have now here in Cheyenne.
That's correct.
And is that so? You said that's a specialist that comes out of someplace. Mr. Chairman, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, yes. In that case, we've had a number of mitigation specialists in that case just because of the varying complexities of our case and our client and his life story. So we've actually had four people help us with mitigation investigation in that case, actually five now.
Okay. And this is their first budget request, and I see where the governor denied. Brett, you have any comments?
Mr. Chairman, I think historically this has been handled on a contractual basis, and I know that the agency's request specifically is related to moving towards having someone on staff. The governor, given the frequency of past capital cases and what appears to be at least at the present time an anomaly in the current biennium with the number of cases that we've had, would like to continue to see that service accessed via contractual relationships.
Okay. Any questions, Brett?
OK.
Okay, continue.
Thank you, Chairman Bebout. And I, you know, I would just add that I hope that it's an anomaly. I hope we don't have seven capital cases in the next year. We do have a, you know, an unresolved case in Park County right now that if it becomes a state jurisdiction case, that that's likely to be a capital case. And I would just add, based on our experiences, contract mitigation specialists, whether they're attorneys or investigators, are expensive. We've had to hire them from California, New York, all over the country to handle the cases that we have. It would be cost-effective and more efficient, and I believe would improve the quality of representation in these cases if we had somebody on board. And I would note that, you know, if by chance we were to get these positions, if we didn't have capital cases, they certainly have cases that they could work on. I have one chief trial counsel who handles the complex cases around the state. Those cases are going up whether they're capital or not, so we would have work for those positions. If no more questions on that, then we jump right into the capital case funding if we did not receive those positions. Based on what we spent on the cases, the request that we've made is $870,000 with, I believe, the $250,000 effective immediately. Generally, historically, at least since I've been the state public defender, the office has received $300,000 a biennium to handle capital cases. And that's in a special project fund. If we don't spend it, it goes back. Unfortunately, though, what happens, and this is another reason why this budget reduction has been tough for us to sustain, when that money runs out of the 90305 series, we still have to pay these experts because we need them. The Constitution requires that we do what we do in these cases. So when that money runs out, then the money comes from the rest of the 900 cases. So that limits or reduces the amount of monies I have for our 14,000 cases that, you know, 10% of them might need an expert. So having that money in that pot now is the best way for us to run our office, not just in our capital cases, but in our regular cases, so that I'm not telling my attorneys, well, we might be out of money, and I don't know if you're going to be able to get an expert or not. We've said no to people on expert requests in the last biennium. Whether or not we did the right thing and whether or not we violated someone's constitutional rights is probably yet to be seen. We felt at supplemental that we needed about another $500,000, and we were pretty close on that. We received, I believe, from the legislature a total of $141,000. The $500,000 request is reduced to $200,000 and then further reduced, I believe, as it was argued to the legislature as a whole. And what that required us to do then, we had to go through a B-11 process that took 3 or 4 months. And I'll be honest with you that part of the money that we got in the B-11 to bring us to balance our 900 series for the entire agency, we had to take it from the Guardian Ad Litem program. Now, they had the money, but they also weren't helping out in Sweetwater County, and we're now helping out in Sweetwater County, so that money won't be there. But it's a difficult process, and it's a stressful process. And in the meantime, I have active cases going all the time, and I'm telling them no to things that maybe they needed.
Mr. Chairman. Diane, what's the current balance of that fund?
Mr. Chairman, if I could maybe hand that over to Ms. Meza, she can give you the numbers on that.
At this, Mr. Chairman and Representative, at this very moment, as of, I guess it was of 1/10/14, we had expended $715,325.37. We had, there's another, I guess, the third or fourth handout that details our balance at this moment.
Like this.
And it's at -$63,314.71.
Okay. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, just a quick clarification. I think there was a reference earlier to the effective immediate request being $250,000, and it's actually $370,000.
Okay. Yeah. I apologize for that, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Diane, on the capital case here, do you have contract counsel do that, or is local counsel doing it? And how many attorneys do you have on the case?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nicholas, we have lead attorney is from Cheyenne, Star Pellet, our attorney here. There are, and then an attorney out of the Casper office who's qualified to do capital cases. Again, not many attorneys are qualified to do that. And that we just have the two attorneys on the case right now, but they aren't there. They belong to us.
Okay.
One of the, I know that Mr. Jones had stated that hopefully, or I said hopefully, that this is an anomaly. You know, hopefully we don't have seven capital cases in the next biennium. And so if you're thinking that giving us this kind of money is a bad idea because we don't know how many cases we have, I just wanted to reiterate again that it's a special project fund. We can only spend it on capital cases, and if we don't spend it, it goes back. And certainly, you know, if that's something we can review and go back to after a year into the supplemental time, we certainly will do that. We're not going to spend money that we don't need to spend. So I just wanted to give you those assurances. Again, we're in the hole, as Ms. Mesa said. If we don't have money at effective immediate in March, I don't know that we can get through the biennium because we're going to be borrowing money from other funds to pay for that capital case. And I have no control over whether or not we end up with one, two, or ten more capital cases between now and July 1st. And then certainly, it's really hard to predict what that's going to be as of June 30th of 2016. We believe the monies that we've requested are constitutionally required. And
you typically don't have any reversions, probably, do you?
Mr. Chairman, we have had some reversions in the last few years. The last biennium, not very much. The year before, we had a bigger reversion. Part of that was because the Guardian Ad Litem program was reverting some monies. This year, I don't anticipate that we will revert any monies.
Okay. Anything else, committee? Continue.
On to page 14, I believe. The third priority in the Public Defender's Office, priority four overall. We're requesting $98,000 to conduct our public defender training. Except for this year, historically, we provide 15 hours of CLE and ethics credit training to our attorneys once a year. Because of the budget cut, because of the increase in cases, and because our capital case cases were siphoning off of the funding for our training, we are unable to conduct our training this year. As I said, to be an effective attorney, you have to know what you're doing. I think if we were to send our – well, we did some studies. If we were to send our attorneys, our 53 attorneys, to training, and we paid for it without doing the training, it would cost us about $60,000 a year, and I could only guarantee that they would receive 3 to 4 hours of relevant training. When we do a training, we talk about matters that involve public defenders. We train them to learn how to do DNA. We talk about mitigation. We talk about what it means to be an investigator. And what we require of our investigators. We also train our staff on all of the rules of being a part of a state agency. We train our staff on what they're allowed to do. They can't practice law without a license. We have to have a lot of discussions about our staff with those types of things. We feel that this public defender training is actually what makes our attorneys some of the best in the state. And I would actually put our attorneys and our public defender program up there with the best in the entire country. And largely because of the training that we provide to our attorneys. We do it in 2.5 days, and we would like to have that monies back. It was part of the monies we cut in the budget reduction, although we didn't realize it would hit us as hard as it did in that area. And again, if this committee or the legislature as a whole has some issues with how much of that money is, you can put it in a special project fund, and we'll come in every year and tell you what we need and only spend what we need and revert back what we don't. But certainly we believe that in order to be effective, we need this money to train our attorneys.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, one question. This may be for Brett. On your page 14 at the bottom on priorities, it talks about the budget office, because of the way it's set up, only pays 84.59% as opposed to the full 85%. But that doesn't make any sense to me that you've got to come back and ask for money for that each time. So.
Yeah, and the other thing along that same line is, you know, just because of the way we did ETS, it's still the obligation of the counties, and I don't know why they still don't pick up that 15%.
Mr. Chairman, Director Lozano, do you mind if I jump in?
I don't, go ahead.
Okay. thanks. This is the next request that she was probably going to speak to, but what this is a correction of that fact that's occurring. The agency needs this $109,000 general fund appropriation so that they can obtain that match from the counties to meet that 85-15 ratio. And through a couple of circumstances, one of which being the ETS transfer of positions, when they transferred their folks at 100% general fund, but their folks are not paid at 100% general fund. So they need this replacement of general fund in the budget to accommodate those occurrences and be able to.
Yeah, well, my question is, and I understand that, but if they're providing services to the public defender that the county should pay 15% of, are they going to still be charged that 15%?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, this amount, this general fund, $109,000, will allow the Office of the Public Defender to build the counties for those services. Right now, the counties are willing to pay for it, but you have to have the matching funds in order to make that 100%. And there is an error with this request that is why I'm jumping in. The way that this was prepared, it's creating a new line item in the 0255 series payments there of $128,000. The agency doesn't need expenditure authority. They just simply need that general fund to correct the situation that's occurring that is outlined in their narrative. So when we get to markup, we'll bring this to your attention again, but what we need to do is just reduce that special revenue funding in this budget of $128,654 to accommodate the $109,000, I know this is confusing, of general fund influx that's required in this budget. So it's just an error in the way the accounting was done in the table that we need to fix during markup, but that it will there. The bottom line will be that the agency gets this $109,000 that it needs.
And it shouldn't cost any more than the budget that we approve when we approve it. It's just about whether we go up or down, that same number would be there, or would it change?
Mr. Chairman, the $128,000, this budget will be reduced by $128,000 in special revenue funds because the agency doesn't need expenditure authority. They just need that general fund.
Okay. Any questions? We got it. Okay, we understand that one. Priority number four, or six, number four, priority six.
Okay, again, we're on page, looks like we're on page 15, and thank you for that explanation. And, Mr. Chairman, that was, I didn't quite understand it, so I'm glad that she jumped in. It's pretty complicated as far as that goes. Our priority number six is just to keep our computers running and effectively, and we have some compatibility issues with different programs. And we met with ETS on two different occasions and went back and forth about what we needed. So this request reflects what we need as far as new computers, upgraded software, telephones. We have attorneys who travel. For instance, our Douglas office handles Douglas, Wheatland, Torrington, and Lusk, so they're on the road a lot. We'd like to get them some cell phones so that they can at least keep in touch with their office and their clients when they're spending the majority of their time behind the wheel. So we would ask for approval of that.
Representative Nicholas.
Thank you. With regards to this, what you don't do is provide us the number of the specifics of this request. All we've got is a hard number. And so I would like to know how many computers it is, what the software is, so that we can break down and know exactly what you're asking for.
Do we have numbers? Mr. Chairman, if I could hand this over to Ms. Mesa, she's the one who made the request and met with ETS.
You know, you can just give us a printout of it or give me a printout of it so I can understand.
Okay.
You don't have to go through it.
Just provide that to
it's us. Actually no computers. We got denied on all printers, no monitors. We're not replacing anything. This is really for Adobe professional software so that our attorneys can edit documents. Right now we don't have that capability. We're using a free PDF writer so that we can print PDFs, but we have no editable capabilities. So $45,000 of that first line is Adobe Pro. $36,000 is for the upgrade of Office Professional. The $15,000 is for desktops in the event that we did get new employees and laptops for traveling, but those are pretty minimal. We cut those down to, I think it was 8 laptops when we have 15 field offices. Then the $85,073 was specifically for out-of-warranty parts. If a computer's out of warranty, we still have to pay to get that item fixed, and we have to pay for that out of our budget. So we're not trying to replace any of our computers or expend more than what we need. We're just trying to supplement and keep going what we have. That last line item, it's large mainly because of new setup of cell phones and iPads. We're asking for those for our supervisors in the field offices that travel, just so that they can keep in touch with the offices. They're having a lot of trouble keeping in touch with the offices with the outdated laptops that we have, and we're just trying to keep them up and running.
Senator Meyer.
We're happy to give you a printout.
Do you have any communication between you and ETS about why they suggested that you do it this way? You're the first agency that
that came in that said we've got software problems and incompatibility, and you bought the software, everybody else is getting new computers, new monitors, and new software. And so it seems like you're doing it in a more cost-effective way, and I'd really like to see how ETS justified how they suggested you do it compared to every other agency.
Well, and Chairman and Senator, I can tell you that the main reason for this is because we replaced all of our computers in this biennium. So we're not having computer issues. That's all been resolved. We did go through ETS to get that all resolved. But ETS did deny us on what they recommended. They did recommend that we get new monitors and new printers, but they did deny us on all of that. So we are keeping things that are approximately 10 years old up and running.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And the rest of them.
Mr. Chairman, I think that brings us to page 17, if I'm correct. On to priority number 10, which shows as number 6 on the public defender side of the budget, and it's a request for $15,000 for office furniture. Our base budget has us at zero. We don't plan to go out and buy everybody new furniture, but certainly we're concerned about when chairs break. We've had some desks that have broken and those types of things. So the governor denied that.
I think we know where we can find 5 chairs.
They would match.
Maybe.
Okay. Sure. Okay. Oh, I guess I skipped over something. I apologize, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Becky.
Yes, you did.
Okay. I apologize, Mr. Chairman. It's actually on the bottom of page 16. We talked about this a little bit with Representative Nicholas. It's a request for funding to help us pay for those court-ordered experts that private attorneys need or for attorney's fees. For one reason or another, this year we've seen a spike in those requests. I believe we've spent $70,000. I think yesterday our amount was $56,000, and then we figured out there was another expert or attorney that we didn't count in those funds. We have talked to the governor's office about attempting to get a statutory change, possibly in the next legislative session. Next year we'll be approaching the legislature as a whole to remove that ability for private attorneys to do that to us. But certainly it's $100,000 that we didn't plan for, that the courts are ordering us to pay it, and we have to pay it. Again, another recommendation for this is I would think the best place for this would be a special project fund, a one-time funding type of thing, not part of our standard budget, just sticking in a special funding so that when we have those requests, we can pay them, and when we don't spend it, we revert it, obviously, immediately back to the general fund.
You know, I'm not sure, you know, as I understand this, they hire the private counsel. I mean, it's a business world, and if they make that decision, then they should accept the responsibility. And if why should the state have to come back if things don't work out for them and pay them? I'm not sure I like that one.
No, I agree.
Maybe
with you,
I'm
Mr.
missing
Chairman.
Something
no.
there.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. Unfortunately, I think the way that the statute's written, I don't think courts believe they have the ability to say no.
Okay. We have the ability to say no on the funding. Okay, continue.
Okay, then the office furniture, as I briefly mentioned, the governor denied our request for $15,000 to buy office furniture in case we need it. No questions on that. On to priority 11. These are the monies that we need to maintain our office vehicles around the state. We do have a printout that we could get to everybody as to where our vehicles are located and what year they are, and that matters as a maintenance, and we get those numbers from the motor pool people, and we have no control over those costs.
Okay. I think that wraps up Public Defender's Office. Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman, we actually have the guardian ad litem.
Oh, I know that. I just wanted to wrap this one up. Any other questions on Public Defender? Okay.
Okay.
Guardian ad litem. 22, page 22.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This budget, I actually, Mr. Chairman, feel a lot more comfortable with. I will tell the committee as a whole that when we entered this budget year, We were not providing services in Sweetwater County. That was a choice that the county made, nor in Goshen County. We have now agreed and entered into a memorandum of understanding with Sweetwater County, so we are now providing services to Sweetwater County. If this budget did not include Sweetwater County, we would be reverting, you know, $500,000, which seems almost irresponsible to me that the budget looked like this. But we are now adding Sweetwater County back in, and a couple of our exceptions requests reflect the adding in of a pretty large caseload and a pretty big county who has some rising costs and out-of-state placements and whatnot.
Representative Nicholas.
Could you explain a little more in detail why you weren't providing Sweetwater County service in 2008? Was it,
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nicholas, you know, that's solely something that the counties, we offered our services to all 23 counties. When we started with the program in 2008, we were. You could probably have to talk to the commissioners as to why they did not want to enter into the MOU with us in the last budget year. Some of it was we have rules and regulations. We want the judges to allow us to appoint the attorneys. We track cases. We assign cases. There was some.
So was the county then covering all the costs for GALs during that period
of
time?
Go ahead.
On page 23 in our narrative, I would point out that we help over 2,000 kids a year, kids who've been abused and neglected by their caregivers and their parents. We believe that it's an important function. The number that we have reflected is the 1,896 kids in 2013 is actually off by 51 cases. For whatever reason, our database didn't catch those. So that's an additional 51 cases there. We mostly have contract attorneys do our work for us. We've moved from doing an hourly itemized billing to paying our attorneys basically a lump sum that they still have to prove that they're doing the work, certainly around the counties. But we do have attorneys. We have one in Casper, one in Gillette, one in Rollins. We'd like one in Rock Springs, and two in Cheyenne who are employees who handle full caseloads. They carry up to 80 cases each. And we have an administrative staff here in Cheyenne that includes our deputy GAL, a legal assistant, and a fiscal assistant. And we also have an attorney who will help with appeals. And if a case goes to trial on termination of parental rights, we now have that attorney and believe that it's about as effective as the Guardian Ad Litem program is going to be. And with that, if there are no further questions. Page 24 outlines our support services. Again, the Guardian Ad Litem services. We don't have that many employees, but we do have travel costs. We do have to reimburse our contract attorneys to travel. We have an attorney who lives in Cody who handles the Bighorn Basin and Guardian Ad Litem cases. So he's in his car a lot, so we have to pay for travel costs. We have provided some vehicles, but again, they have to spend the night. There's all those different travel costs. We, up to this point in time, had not provided Westlaw to those attorneys. That's one of our exceptions requests. That would be in the 200 and 400 series. But the biggest chunk of our expenses in Guardian Ad Litem is within the 900 series. Occasionally, we have to provide experts, but that's largely a county expense, so we don't have to worry about that.
Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
And Ms. Lozano, so looking at the bottom of 24, you've got this indication that you can bill counties up to 25% of the cost. And then I just flipping forward to the Sweetwater County request, it looks like only 20% match. And maybe I'm looking at two different things, but I guess my bottom line question is, are you, in fact, charging all the counties that 25%?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Stubson, we are. It comes out looking 80-20 because it's a match rather than paying a percentage of a whole. And it's. I've tried to explain it to our new fiscal person in the Guardian Ad Litem a couple of times. I don't know that I'm going to be able to explain it. But if you were to take $100 and we pay it all up front, but the county has to pay 25% of what we pay, that breaks down to we pay $80, they pay $20. But that comes out to the 25% match. And the budget office might be able to help you understand that better than I do.
These sound like some math discussions I've had with my fourth grader. But
everybody's looking at everybody like who's going to answer the question.
Chairman and Representative, I'm going to kind of jump in.
the 25% is of what we spend. It's 25% of the spent, and it turns into 20% of the total. So if you take that $80 of the 100, you take $80 and you take 25% of that $80, it comes out to the 20 instead of. So it's of a match, not a whole. It's a very difficult concept to explain, but it is 25% of what we spend, not 25% of the total.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now that that's crystal clear.
And Mr. Chairman, every county has agreed to the same 25%. It's the same across the board, but when you split it out for budget purposes, it does look like 20%.
Okay.
As she. Okay, so then on page 25, our first exceptions request, the governor denied our request for an employee position. We'd like a full-time employee who works for us. In the Rock Springs office, we think there's going to be about 130 cases, so that's not going to be enough. But certainly we've learned, especially with the Guardian at Lighten program, is if we have somebody working for us and they're dedicated to the mission and the purpose of the Guardian at Lighten's office and they follow all the spending and reimbursement rules of the state of Wyoming, it's more effective and it's more cost-saving. The governor has denied the request for the position, though, but has recommended monies for a full-time contractor. Which isn't the same, but it's better than a part-time contractor. So we would we'd ask the committee to consider giving us that position, but if not, certainly money so we can hire a full-time contract attorney in Sweetwater County. It's a unique situation. I think we're going to have to overcome some, for lack of a better term, some hard feelings there, and it's going to be helpful to have somebody full-time there handling that for us.
Okay. Any questions? Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Page 26, priority, overall priority number 7, number 2 in the Guardian ad litem. I think Ms. Meza explained to you what these requests are as far as the IT. We've got the Adobe Pro. I think we do have to replace some desktops, but again, we have printouts that we can show everybody what was requested and what ETS recommended to break that down further.
I believe we're on priority number 9, number 3.
On page 27, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know that Representative Nicholas, I believe, asked District Attorney Blonigan if all of his attorneys had access to Westlaw. And as I stated earlier, our Guardian ad litem attorneys did not have access to Westlaw. In the Public Defender's Program, we provide each one of our attorneys a license to Westlaw. So we needed to add that money in for our Guardian ad litem attorneys. So that they can get online and research and do their work.
Mr. Chairman, and I have a question about, first of all, the way that paragraph A is couched, because you say because of the NACC and the ABA standards that you must have access to electronic legal research. And to me, that sounds like a conclusion. Is that your conclusion or is that their conclusion?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nichols, I think it's their conclusion more than, I mean, initially that's where we started from, but what we've been doing in the Guardian ad litem program is we had one attorney who had access to Westlaw, and we have 20-some contract attorneys calling in and asking him to do all this research, and that's just not effective when we're located throughout the state.
And Mr. Chairman, if you're creative and if you can't afford Westlaw as a small practitioner, most of the things you can find are you can find on the Internet without using Westlaw other than specialized information. So, have you created workshops on how to find stuff and not have to expend the money on Westlaw or even tried Lexis because it's cheaper than Westlaw?
Mr. Chairman, we have, I can tell you, and Deputy Wild could maybe add to this conversation a little bit. We have had some negotiations with Lexis, and it's my understanding, and I hope I'm not speaking out of turn, that the Attorney General's office had some issues with Lexis. They didn't want to sign our contracts. They didn't want to agree to indemnify and those types of things. So I don't know what the costs were, but I know that the state of Wyoming – through the Attorney General's office prefers Westlaw because they will abide by the contracts that the AG approves. So I think certainly that's part of it. And as far as, accessing information on the Internet, I'm sure that some of that's true, but we know that Westlaw you can shepherdize. You know that your case is real, that the authority stands. You can compare to other jurisdictions. There are a lot of things that you can do with Westlaw that are unique to what we do that you couldn't get elsewhere.
Senator Meyer.
So I want to be a clear understanding where we're taking someone who's a private contract attorney. Now, do these private contract attorneys are they prohibited from practicing any other law?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer. If they're part-time, they're not.
But if they're full-time, then they're prohibited from practicing any law, and you're
right,
just giving Westlaw to the full-time contract attorneys?
Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, that's correct. It would be for the
Please identify yourself.
I apologize. Mr. Chairman, Dan Wild. I'm the administrator of the Guardian Ad Litem program, and the Westlaw access would be for the full-time contractors.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Anything else? Continue.
Down to priority 12 at the bottom of page 27, again, is a request for money for furniture and supplies. The governor did recommend, I believe, $5,000, about half of what we requested. And if this committee sees that that's fit, we can live with that amount also. And then on to the final request. And it's our last priority, but it is a priority that the governor felt that he should recommend. Briefly, as I said, we have guardian ad litem attorneys around the state. For instance, the particular attorney we'd like to get a legal specialist for or legal assistant for is in Campbell County. He handles at least 80 cases. That's what we require him to do. Hopefully he's not over that, but he has. So he's representing 18 kids, and his obligation in a guardian ad litem case requires him to do all sorts of investigation and record collection and meeting with social workers and going to visit the child in his home and visiting future placements and MDTs, which are multidisciplinary team meetings, and court hearings. And on top of that, he's answering his own phones and doing his own scheduling and doing all of his paperwork and filings with the court. Now, certainly we expect our attorneys to do their own research and to write their own motions, but there are some things that a legal assistant actually can do a lot quicker than an attorney is. Motion to continue a hearing, motion to have somebody present in the courtroom, which you need special permission in those cases. But not only that, on top of that, our attorney in Gillette is also supervising the attorneys that handle the cases in the 6th Judicial District. He's not the only attorney. So he's getting all of the case appointments from the judges and assigning them and sending us paperwork down here to Cheyenne, and then hopefully someday he'll be entering information onto a case management system, which we're currently working on for the guardian ad litem program. For those of you who do legal work and those of you who don't, I'm sure that you can imagine how hard it would be to be doing that all on your own without any assistance. We would like to this committee to approve our request for a legal assistant who can help him do the administrative duties and some of his legal type work up in Campbell County.
Question I have is, you rank this as number 13 priority, which is, I think, your last one.
It is.
And then you go to Sweetwater County and it was like number 3. What's the difference? Is there caseload? Is that based on your decision, or why would you do it differently in those two cases?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the reason we went with Sweetwater County first is because that is new to us. That county is new to us. And based on what we know from cases and caseloads, we feel like we need the full-time attorney there. And this last request is for a legal assistant for an office that is very busy.
Yeah, why wouldn't you want to do a contract person up there part-time or something? Instead of full-time,
Mr. Chairman. I suppose we could hire a part-time legal assistant. It's a little bit easier to hire part-time attorneys than it is legal assistants on a part-time basis. So
it's always easier when they work for you. Then you pick up the phone, they respond, and the other extra group, it has saved you money in the long run a lot of ways, too. So
I would think so.
Okay. The way I look at it, that completes guardian ad litem, correct?
I think so.
Any last questions, committee? Any last questions? I don't anticipate a call back, but if you're so flexible, and we do once again appreciate that, and do apologize for what we put you through today, but well done.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, committee, it's now 12 o'clock. Yeah, how about 12:30 we come back? No. How about 1:30? And we will start at 1:30. That gives us time to get some lunch and get our heads on. Is that okay? You heard that before? Okay, thanks. We'll see you all at 1:30.